Well, having been at the singing school, I can assure you that Brother Tim followed nothing that we taught him. And for that, we are eternally grateful. Otherwise, it would have been really interesting this morning. So we learned from him. What a great week it was for VBS. Again, what Gene said, there's a lot of people went into work putting us all together. And I had some good crowds every night. And so it's always a lot of work, a lot of exercise, and I'll publicly admit, just as much as some of you did, I won't name names, but I will give you initials later, that we were all glad to see Thursday night come, because it's been a busy time. But then we got to go spend a couple of days down in Tampa, and really enjoyed being with Brother Tim and learning about the song leading and the young men that went. It's very uplifting, and what a great service this morning. And appreciate him taking the opportunity to do that. I think Rick was really despondent that he wasn't going to get the lead singing this morning. He looks like he's worried about that. Genesis chapter 3 is where we're going to begin this morning. We've been doing a series of lessons entitled Lessons from Eden. And we're looking at some very important points just in this one little chapter. And of course, it is the focus of what so much, of course, the scriptures are going to be about. As God has created the world, made it into a very beautiful place, called it all good. Matter of fact, called it very good. In Genesis chapter 3, verse 1, it says that the serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, "Has God indeed said that you shall not eat of every tree of the garden?" The woman said to the serpent, "That we may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God has said that you shall not eat it, nor shall you touch it, lest you die." Then the serpent said to the woman, "That you will not surely die. God knows that in the day that you eat of it, your eyes are going to be open, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." So when the woman saw the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree desirable to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. She also gave to her husband with her, and he ate. Then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together, made themselves coverings, and they heard the sound of the Lord walking into the garden in the cool of the day. And Adam and his wife hid themselves in the presence of the Lord God among the trees of the garden. Then the Lord called to Adam and said, "Where are you?" He said, "Well, I heard your voice in the garden. I was afraid because I was naked and I hid myself." And he said, "Well, who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten from the tree of which I commanded you that you should not eat?" The man said, "Well, the woman whom you gave to me to be with me, she gave me of the tree and I ate." And the Lord God said to the woman, "Well, what is this that you have done?" The woman said, "The serpent deceived me and I ate." A lot of lessons there. We began in this series talking about how that when they recognized what sin was, the first thing they recognized that they were naked. There were principles that we have established about God's view about covering the body. We talked about sin, obviously, as a subject of this chapter, and how that they disobeyed God and sin entered into the world. Last Sunday, we talked about being Father's Day, that the lessons that fathers teach their children about marriage and how important the covenant of marriage is established in the garden. This morning we're going to talk about that statement that Adam made when God asked him what was going on and that he was hiding, and why was he doing that. And Adam said, "Well, you know, it's that woman that you gave me. Now I'm going to tread lightly and quickly get out of this phraseology before I get into too much trouble." But it really becomes a pattern of excuses and trying to blame somebody else and to think, "Well, it's not my fault, and it's always somebody else's fault." And that this is a pattern that man has always really struggled with, of trying to assume the responsibility or even trying to blame others. And in baseball, I know Hector will enjoy this, that there was a manager of a minor league baseball team that was quite disgusted with his center fielder's performance And so he ordered him to the dugout, and he went out and assumed the position himself. And so the first ball came into the center field. Well, it took a bad hop and hit the manager right in the mouth. And the next one was a high fly ball, which he lost in the glare of the sun until it bounced off his forehead. And the third was a hard line drive that he charged with outstretched arms, and unfortunately it right between his hands and smacked him in the eye. Well, he was furious, and he ran back to the dugout and grabbed the center fielder by the uniform and said, "You've got center field so messed up that I can't even do such a thing, anything out there with it either." You know, it's always the other guy. It's always somebody else's fault. It's always about what's going to happen to the other person. And sadly, this is not really a great moment in the history of man. It's also not a great moment, fellows, in the history of manhood. Because here, Adam is hiding from the Lord, he and Eve, because they're scared to death. They don't know what's about to happen. Their eyes have been opened, and they hear the voice of God walking in the garden. And I only suppose that on other occasions before sin entered the world, that was a very comforting sound. They were enjoying the blessing of walking with God in the garden. But now things are very different. They're actually trying to hide from God. And I think it's a very interesting question that God says, you know, where are you? He knows where Adam's at. He's trying to call Adam out. And what are you hiding there for? And, well, I'm scared, and I'm afraid because I'm naked. Well, now, wait a minute. Who told you that you were naked? Well, that woman whom you gave me, you know. We still do that, don't we, guys? You know, it's all the wife's fault. But, you know, Adam wasn't being very bold in this time when he knew what happened. Now, we go back to the story and remember that Satan comes to Eve and deceives her, and she gives to Adam. I think it's probably fair to assume that Adam was close by. I don't think she had to go find him anywhere, and that Adam could very well have likely heard the whole conversation and thought, well, you know, if you do it, then okay, we'll do it. And so they both ate of the fruit. But again, what he does is that he doesn't take any responsibility to himself. He just simply says, as the woman that you gave me, she gave it to me and she forced me. I mean, you know what? I don't know what happened. I just took it and I ate it. Well, he didn't say forced, but of course that's probably the idea. And the fact is that we're always looking for somebody to blame for something that we've done. And that's because in the nature of sin, we're not as comfortable with saying, well, now, okay, I got this one now because I know it was me. And Adam is really an illustration of the deceitfulness of sin, because the search for someone to blame is always going to be successful. If you want to blame somebody for something, you will find some way, some place, some time, and it's going to be a blame. Well, it wasn't me, and it was about that. And that's really what Adam has done. It's easy just to simply blame others. He didn't take accountability to himself. He didn't say that, well, you know, I should have told her that we shouldn't have done this. Maybe he could have said that I knew better, and I don't know what to... But, you know, he still just blamed everybody else. There is nothing in this statement that he accepts any responsibility. As a matter of fact, as we'll see, he even blames God. I mean, of all things, all this coming about and all that was done, and he's not going to assume any responsibilities. And this is not really any different than when we come to Aaron in the book of Genesis in the 32nd chapter, although it's a little bit more humorous, I guess, in some ways, because you remember, of course, the children of Israel have been released from Egypt. They have come down to Mount Sinai. They're receiving the commandment, and, well, Moses, yeah, the guy on the mountain, and that says Genesis, and my secretary mistyped that. That should read Exodus, but he's going to be fired when we get back into our meeting next week. That should read Exodus chapter 32. But and I say I'm making an excuse. Did you see that? You didn't catch that. You just went right over your head, didn't you? You did it. In Exodus chapter 32, and I really did that intentionally, we have them at the Mount Sinai, and they don't know what's going on with Moses up there. So in verse 1, the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain. People gathered together to Aaron and said, "Come, make us gods that will go before us." As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what's become of him. And so Aaron said, well, break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me. All the people broke off the golden earrings which were in their ears. They brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold from their hand, fashioned it with an engraving tool, made a golden calf. Notice what Moses says. He received the gold from their hand. He fashioned it with an engraving tool and made a molded calf and said, this is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt. And he also built an altar before it there in verse 5 and said, well, tomorrow we're going to have a great feast. Well, in the meantime, of course, Moses is there on the mountain, knows what's kind of going on, and comes down off of the mountain, and God has said, you need to go down and check on those people because I'm about to wipe them out. And so he comes down, and he is going to, destroy these people had it not been for the intercession of Moses. And so we come down to verse 21. Moses is now speaking, by the way, to his older brother, his kin, as it was. Moses says to Aaron, what did this people do to you that you have brought so great a sin upon them? And one of the things that I miss about the reading is that you really would love to hear the inflections of the voices here and how Aaron is going to maybe say, don't let the anger of my Lord become hot. You know these people, that they're set on evil. And they said to me, we'll make us gods that shall go before us. And as for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what's become of him. And I said to them, whatever has any gold, let him break it off. So they gave it to me, and I cast it into the fire, and this calf came out. How's that going to work for you? You know, I don't know. I was just standing around, and we didn't know what happened to you. And they said, we want to do something. So I said, well, just give me your stuff. And we took it, and I threw it into the fire and backed up, and poof, there comes this calf. I don't know. I mean, isn't that kind of child? We do that. You know, we catch one of our children doing something, and they're standing there with chocolate all over their face. And who's been into the fudge? I don't know. Wasn't me. Well, I didn't do it, you know. Well, my brother made me do it. See, the advantage of being the youngest of six, and especially the youngest of five brothers, man, I had four other excuses. Oh, Ross did it. Yeah, Brad, he did it. We always want to blame somebody else. And so here is Aaron, and he says, well, you know the people. You know how this is all going to come about. Again, not taking the responsibility. It didn't work out like that. I mean, it didn't work because there were people that died because of this. But isn't that an easy thing to do? This is, well, I just don't know. I mean, he's the one, as we read a moment ago, he's the one who told them, okay, bring me your gold. And in verse 4, it says, he fashioned it. I wonder when Moses is writing this years later. You ever think about the kind of the hindsight lessons? Moses is writing this book years later. And as he's writing this, as the Holy Spirit is directing, he's thinking, yeah, I remember that day, and Aaron was trying to use a lot of excuses about what happened, but you know, I know what happened. I know that he's the one, you know. And yet Aaron is trying to say, well, it wasn't me, it was the people, always trying to find somebody else to blame. And of course, we know that's what happened with Saul in 1 Samuel chapter 15. Again, the first king of Israel, and God had told him that I want you to go and punish Amalek for what he did to Israel. And he tells him in 1 Samuel 15 and verse 3, I want you to go, and I want you to attack Amalek, and I want you to utterly destroy all that they have. Do not spare them. Kill both man, woman, infant, nursing child, ox, sheep, camel, donkey. God wanted the Amalekites completely annihilated off the face of the earth. Nobody is to survive, not even the animals. Well, Saul gathered the people together, about 200,000 foot soldiers, 10,000 men, went out and did his thing and came back. But we see, though, in verse 7, that he attacked the Amalekites from Havilah all the way down to Shur, which is the east of Egypt, and he also took Agag, king of the Amalekites, alive and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep and the oxen and the fatlings and the lambs and all that was good and were unwilling to utterly destroy them, but everything despised and worthless. Well, they utterly destroyed that. Well, it's kind of like in the garden. It's not as if God didn't know what happened. And so Samuel comes to him and, you know, what is this you've done? Verse 13, Samuel comes to Saul and said, and Saul says to Samuel, blessed are you of the Lord. I have performed the commandment of the Lord. And Samuel said, well, what then is this bleating of the sheep in my ears and the lowing of the oxen which I hear? And notice what Saul says. They have brought them from the Amalekites. For the people spared the best of the sheep and the oxen to sacrifice to the Lord your God, and the rest we have utterly destroyed. Well, where'd that come from? Well, see, the people, they just wanted it, and I have to be a good king. And so it wasn't my idea. Oh, I thought, I told them, no, we ought not do this. Now, God told us we need to utter it. But, you know, it's their fault. They did that. And he's blaming the people. He's the king, and responsibility should, of course, begin there. But the fact is that he is trying to, as we say, he's throwing them underneath the bus and saying that, oh, it wasn't my fault. They did it. And it's because of that. And so what we see, and there's so many examples of that in Scripture, is it is very easy when we are confronted with a circumstance, oh, well, it's not my fault. I didn't do that. I didn't have anything to do with it at all. It's somebody else's fault. Well, I think it's important that we do a contrast because we look at these guys. Well, we need to see how it should be done. And we remember, of course, the familiar story in 2 Samuel chapter 12 about how that David saw a woman bathing on her rooftop, and he had her come to him and committed adultery with her. Her name was Bathsheba. And her husband, Uriah, was one of his mighty men. And while Uriah was out fighting, this occurred. So a few months later, when Bathsheba came to David and said, I'm pregnant. And there's some things you just don't cover up. You just can't cover up pregnancy. And David said, well, we got to do something. So he calls Uriah back in from the war and says, hey, you know, been fighting. Well, go home and, you know, to cover the thing up. Well, Uriah is, by the way, is a Hittite. And you know the lesson that if your last name is Ite, you're not a good person. Because all the Ites were supposed to be annihilated. All the Hittites and the Amalekites and the Jebusites and the Hittites and all them other Ite people that, you know, if you had, I'm just kidding. All those Ite people. Well, he was actually a Hittite, a person of that, that group of people that were supposed to be annihilated, but he's married to this Jewish girl. And he's one of David's mighty men. He's one of his SEAL team guys. He's one of those really important people. And so, Uriah has more integrity and more character than David because he refuses to go and spend his time with his wife while his men are out there suffering. Well, that didn't work. And of course, we know that what David does is he says, okay, hang around a little while. Let's have a party. He got him drunk, thinking a drunk person will just sort of stumble home. Well, he didn't do that either. What does he finally do? Well, we know what he does. He sends a note by Uriah in his own hand to Joab to tell him that when you go back to battle, I want you to take Uriah. I want him to take him to the heat of the battle. And when it gets really hot, I want you to withdraw, and I want that man dead. That's exactly what Joab does. And then it says that David comforted Bathsheba. Well, she was still pregnant. And this thing that David had done displeased him. When we come to 2 Samuel chapter 12, we have God sending Nathan the prophet to him and to tell him an amazing story. There in verse 1, it says that Nathan says to David, he's telling David this story. There were two men in one city, one rich, one poor. The rich man had exceedingly many flocks and herds. The poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb which he had bought and nursed. And it grew up together with him and with his children. It ate of his own food and drank from his own cup and lay in his bosom, and it was like a daughter to him. A traveler came to the rich man and refused to take from his own flock and from his own herd to prepare one for the wayfaring man who had come to him. But he took the poor man's lamb, prepared it for the man who had come. Oh, David just got hot. His anger was greatly aroused against the man, and he said to Nathan, as the Lord lives, the man who has done this shall surely be put to death. And he will need to restore fourfold for the lamb because he did this thing and because he had no pity. And Nathan says to David, you are the man. You are the man. And David, in verse 13, did not blame Bathsheba. He could have. What's a woman doing like that on top of her roof? Bathing like that, knowing that, you know, my palace is higher than everybody else's, and maybe she knew, you know, discussions are made. Well, maybe Bathsheba knew he was there. Why did he blame her? Why did he blame the fears of the war? Well, you know, the pressures of war, the pressures of, you know, I just needed, you know, I don't know what. I mean, he could have given a multitude of excuses. He was the king. He could have given every one of them and they would have been accepted. But that wasn't the kind of man that David was. I can only imagine that the countenance of David was such that when Nathan came to him, you know, months that were transpiring, probably close to the end of the 9 months, because the child was born shortly thereafter, and David may have concerned himself about this thing. And maybe seeing Nathan, he kind of thought, oh, you know, but then he started telling this story. Well, okay, I'm not a problem, off the hook here. Well, that's an interesting story about this guy who took his neighbors. Oh, boy. But then it dawned on him when Nathan looked at him, I think, with piercing eyes and said to David, you're the man. David knew. He knew. And his countenance fell, and he didn't blame anybody else. He blamed the person that needed to be blamed. He said, I have sinned against the Lord. That's all he said. He didn't offer reasons. He didn't try to say, he didn't. He just said, I have sinned against the Lord. Why? Because he knew. I did this. Okay? I am the one who am responsible. And I think we find that same spirit in the prodigal son in Luke 15. And we talk about all that he did. And of course, there's a great story here about love of a father and how that his father was waiting and longing for him to come back. It's a parable. Remember that it's about a certain man who had two sons. One decided that he wanted to have everything and wanted and go and live, you know, life like he wanted, which he did. He took it, his possessions, and he lived it in prodigal living. And it says in verse 14, but when he had spent all, there arose a severe famine in the land, and he began to be in want. And he went and joined himself to a citizen of that country, and he sent him into his fields to feed swine. He'd gladly have filled his stomach with the pods that the swine ate, and nobody gave him anything. The key is verse 17. He came to himself, and he said, how many of my father's hired servants have bread enough and to spare, and I perish with hunger? I will arise and go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, you're the blame for this. If you'd have been a better father, I wouldn't be where I'm at today. Because I needed things from you, and you didn't give them to me. As a matter of fact, Mom wasn't much help either. Because I should have had a better child bring it. I should have been treated better when I was a child. And you know, those teachers at school, they were mean to me. And they didn't give me a lot of encouragement, and things just really didn't work out well. And boy, you look at society itself, it's just sort of gone to the pot anyway. I mean, the whole world, and you know, I'm young, okay? I've got to sow my wild oats, and you know, you need to get that, Dad, okay? So, we good? Nah. What he did, this is such a powerful statement. Because he begins by saying, Father, this is what he's going to say to him. He's thinking of this in the pig pen, by the way. He's not even left. He's not even gone anywhere. He still has the stench of the hogmire there. He still is incredibly hungry. He is still miserable. And he is saying to himself, this is what I'm going to say. Father, and he's got this in the right order, I've sinned against heaven and before you. And he's right. Because what he did was sinful to God. And he put that in the right order. He said, that's where it starts, with God. But I've also sinned against you. And he goes on to say, and what a powerful sermon it is here in verse 19, I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants. I'm so ashamed of what I have done. I don't even want to be your son anymore. I want to be the person that scrubs the floor. I want to be the person that cleans out the hog pen. I want to be the person that just does the menial stuff, because I have brought such shame upon you. I have brought such shame upon God. Here is a broken and contrite heart. Here is a young man who's not blaming his parents. He's not blaming society. He's not blaming everything else that would give license to say, well, that's just the way people are. Vance Havner said that the prodigal son could have thought up a list of alibis a yard long in that pigsty, but his salvation began when he resolved to say, I have sinned. And there are many modern prodigals eating husk who have 100 excuses, and they go on feeding hogs. There is no deliverance until we stop passing the buck. It's me. It's me, O Lord. Standing in the need of prayer. You see the contrast? They didn't blame. Oh, they could have. There's a lot of reasons that people can give, but they didn't blame. And Psalm 51 is so powerful when David, speaking of this sin of Bathsheba, and I want you to notice how many times that he recognizes it's him. It's him. I acknowledge my transgression. I want to tell you what I've done. This is a prayer to God. My sin is always before me. This is personal. Against you and you only, I have sinned. That's a contrite heart. That's someone who is willing to accept the blame. I am the one who has done this evil. And what he does in this prayer of forgiveness is that he acknowledges the greatness and the majesty of God, that you may be found just when you speak and blameless when you judge. Somebody said that when you blame others, you give up your power to grow. Oh, we like to blame others. We like to think that it's somebody else's fault the way things are going on, but it's not really. We're to blame. And Psalm 51 is truly my favorite passage in the whole Bible, and I don't like it, because it makes it personal. Because it's about me and God. It's not about you. It's about me and God. And the thing that we find about David and the prodigal, in contrast to others like Adam and Saul, is we have to realize that it's about us. Oh, there's lessons to learn there, because there's always going to be somebody to blame. Adam blamed the woman. A few of you who are old enough remember Flip Wilson made a lot of money. The devil made me do it. You know, the fact of the matter is, the devil don't even make us do anything either. You can't even blame him. Eve didn't blame. I think her answer was less excusing, because when God says to this, what have you done? She said, well, he deceived me and I ate. She doesn't really give accountability, I guess, but the fact of the matter is, we can't even blame Satan. Oh, I'd like to blame him. I mean, there's a grand scheme. Yes, we can lay the blame in him of what he is, but when I sin, it's not because he makes me do it, because he really doesn't. He tempts me. I do it. You can't blame your parents. Doesn't mean that they couldn't have had a better influence. You can't blame society. Sure, we could have lived in a better time. You can't blame anybody. You can't blame your family. You can't blame your job. You can't blame your health. There's reasons that we want to say, well, this is the way I am. We can't do that. Blaming your faults on your nature does not change the nature of your faults. An old Indian proverb says. But there's an excuse for anything. I mean, we can come up with excuses. As a matter of fact, the 10 most used excuses are, I forgot. No one told me to go ahead. I didn't think it was that important. Wait until the boss comes back and ask him. If I didn't know you were in a hurry for it. Or that's the way we've always done it. Well, that's not my department. How was I to know this was different? I'm waiting for an okay. Well, that's his job and not mine. I mean, we could come up with all kinds of excuses. As a matter of fact, Adam did that with God. The woman you gave me, you know. best thing that ever happened to him. Amen? Yeah, well, okay, guys. Oh, there's always excuses. Always reasons why we're going to do what we're going to do. And you can find an excuse. But the reality of it is that there's no one to blame but me. I can blame a lot of people. Yeah. But in the end, the only person that Adam can blame was himself. And in the end, the only person that Aaron could blame was himself. And so the list goes. And I think this is crucial to understand the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. One individual sacrificed himself for the whole world because we're going to be judged on an individual basis. I think where this brings us to is the realization that, you know, it's about me and God. Understand what I mean? It's not about you. It's about me. Because when we all stand in judgment, and you and I are all going to be there one day, you can't answer for me. And I can't answer for you. Husbands are not going to be able to answer for wives, and wives are not going to be able to answer for husbands, and parents are not going to be able to answer for their children, nor children to their parents. In any respect, in any regard, we're going to be judged in a very narrow scheme of things. And what Jesus came to do was to die because we're going to be judged as one individual. That's the relationship that I have with Him. It's not so much about whether or not you're saved, because that's not may not going to do me any good. It's going to be about what I'm going to do and how I'm going to stand before God. Because what we realize in the Scriptures, as Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 10, we've all got to be there. We're all going to appear before the judgment seat of God, that each one may receive the things done in the body according to what He has done, whether good or bad. We're going to be with the mass humanity of people that have ever lived, that are living and will live before the coming of the Lord, and we're going to be there all by ourselves. We're going to be there all by ourselves. Because that's where we have got to lay our relationship with the Lord. There will be no excuses on the day of judgment. There will be no blaming. It'll just be me and the Lord. The question, what must I do to be saved, is personal. The man who is drowning is only thinking of himself. Because he realizes that that's all that there is. Me. If you're not a Christian, that's you. It's not about me. It's not about the person sitting next to you. It's not about your parents. It's not about your school. It's not about your job. It's not about society. It's not about the preacher. It's not about the church. It's not about any of that stuff. All the excuses and all the blame that you lay for not becoming a Christian is going to be taken away when we all stand before God in judgment, and He's going to ask you, why not? And it's just going to be you. And when the Philippian jailer asked Paul, what must I do to be saved? He recognized that it was something that he had to do. And we've got to answer that call. And when all is said and done, can't blame anybody else. If you're not saved, you can't blame God. You can't blame Christ. You can't blame anybody but yourself. Who will follow Jesus? Who will make reply? I'm the one that's on the Lord's side. I am going to be the one that's going to make that decision. Regardless of what the whole world does, regardless of what the whole world says, I am going to answer this morning the call of the military call of God to come be one of His soldiers. Who's going to follow Jesus? It isn't about me. It's about you. Me's about me. You's about you. Who are you going to blame? Don't let this day go by. Let's stand as we sing.
Who will follow Jesus standing for a ride, holding up His banner in the